The RF 1015 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. So members, we have a full agenda today. I was going to go first. I have to take a call at probably about 11:15 or so. So at some point, I'm going to get that done. But I think what I'll do is we'll just go down the agenda here. I'll start out with House File 2969. Members, if you could take that out of your members, if you could please take that out. 2969. We have the Peterson bill before us. I will move House File 2969 when we have a quorum. So welcome to the committee. Where is she? Oh, there she is. Okay. Yeah. Okay, let's see what we got here. Oh, treats and snacks. Oh, they're pretty healthy. M&M's. Brown ones. The brown ones are good. Okay, that looks delicious. Send them around, everybody. Well, thank you, and welcome to the Tax Committee. I will move House File 2969 when we have a quorum. And Representative Peterson, I will break in when we do have a quorum to get us officially going here. And if we don't have a quorum by the time you're done, then when we do have a quorum, I'll move your bill. You wouldn't have to be here. So with that, if you please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2969 is a bill that would provide a $2,000 tax credit for families of stillborn children. A recent study showed that unexpected costs up to $15,000 above the expected costs of medical care, and things like an autopsy, funeral expenses, therapy, and lost productivity are just some of those items that happen when a terrible tragedy hits a family like this. So this bill provides for a one-time tax credit to offset these unexpected expenses. So you must have a certificate of stillbirth, and this has been passed in four states, and we would be the fifth state if this bill moves forward. And it has stillborns are classified as 20 weeks of gestation or later, but before birth. And in Minnesota, there's 300 to 400 fetal deaths, and the rates were per 1,000 were 4.6 in 2005 to 6.4 in 1991. Today, they're in 2013, they're at 5.6 per 1,000. So you do see that there is a fiscal note of $800,000. And this bill has had strong bipartisan support, both in the House and the Senate. And I do have a couple testifiers here, Mr. Chair, at your discretion. And
thank you, Representative Peterson. Is there anyone other than who's on my list? I have Chris and Amanda Duffy, Dale and Carrie Fuller, Lindsay Wimmer. Did I say that right?
Wimmer?
Okay. That's who I have. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill in support of it? Is there anyone that wishes to testify against, with concerns on the bill? Okay, I see no opposition from the audience. So what we'll do is, I don't know if you know what that means in this committee. Thanks for the treats and snacks, by the way. There's nobody that wants to testify against the bill, so that's okay. Does the department wish to weigh in on this bill? Oh, not at this point? Okay. Thank you very much. So let's start out with your witnesses. And since there's no opposition, we can, I mean, this is an extremely important issue, but we can kind of shorten it up. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you for having us. My name is Amanda Duffy, and my husband is Chris Duffy.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So our story started November 2nd of 2014. We woke up in the morning excited to spend our last day as a family of three. We were going to take our oldest son, Rogan, to the park and relax and get a good night's sleep. I was 39 weeks pregnant, and the next day was my scheduled C-section. This pregnancy was a little bit different than our first. At 35 weeks, I was diagnosed with severe polyhydramnios, which basically just means I had an excess of amniotic fluid, and they couldn't figure out why. And so my gut was telling me that something wasn't right and this baby needed to come out. So I had asked for an early delivery, but we were denied that and said nothing can happen before 39 weeks because you and your baby are handling this pregnancy very well. And so that at that point, that's when I asked for a C-section, because I knew 39 weeks would be, that would be when the C-section would be scheduled. So we moved on with that plan. And so my last ultrasound was just 3 days prior. The baby wasn't moving much, but we were told everything looks great, we're going to continue on, and the next Monday was when we were going to have a scheduled C-section. So after going to the park that Sunday, I went home, fed our son lunch, and that's when I started to realize that I hadn't felt the baby move that much that morning. And so I ate something sugary, drank something cold, and laid down, which is what they always tell you to do if the baby hasn't been moving. I did that for about a half hour, waited and waited, and nothing. So at that point, that's when I told my husband. We called the doctor, and the doctor said, you know what, why don't you come in? Maybe the baby just needs a car ride to be woken up. But on that car ride to the hospital is when I knew something wasn't right. We got to the hospital, and the nurse had just said, you know, since you're here today, it's a Sunday, we'll just do your C-section, even though it was planned for the next day. She put the fetal monitor on my stomach and couldn't hear anything, so then she asked me at that point, where do we usually hear the baby's heartbeat? And I thought, well, I'm huge, anywhere. And still nothing. And at that point, that's when I knew something wasn't right. So she went and got the doctor. The doctor brought the ultrasound machine into the room, turned it towards herself, so I couldn't see the screen. And she put the fetal Doppler on my stomach and just sat in the exact same spot that we always would hear our baby's heartbeat. And she just stared at the screen. And at that point, she looked at me and said, I'm sorry, but there's no heartbeat. My husband thankfully started asking questions because I lost it, and she stopped him and said, there's one more thing I want to do. I want to break your water and check for some brain activity for your baby. And so she inserted two clips into the baby's skull, and there was traces of brain activity. So I was rushed in for an emergency C-section.
Sir Chair, my name is Chris Duffy. I'm Amanda's husband. I'm just going to pick up our
Welcome
story.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I'll pick up our story very briefly. Reese Christine.
Okay, excuse me one second. We have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of April 7th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I will now move House File, the Peterson Bill, House File 2969, before the committee. Mr. Duffy.
Thank you. Reese Christine Duffy was born on November 2nd, 2014 at 4:47 p.m. The umbilical cord was wrapped tightly around her neck two times, which cut off her lifeline. The extra amniotic fluid in Amanda's stomach created a larger pool for Reese to move around and get tangled up, which led to her heartbreaking loss. I'm going to show you a picture, not to shock you, but I just want to show you that she looks like a beautiful, living child. She was beautiful, healthy, red hair. She weighed 8 pounds, had perfectly colored skin. She looked like she was alive but sleeping. But as you know, she wasn't sleeping. She was dead. The policy that encourages hospitals to wait until 39 weeks to deliver is what killed Reese. In the hours that followed, we were forced to answer painful questions we never thought we'd have to answer. Would you like to have Reese baptized before we take her away? What would you like the funeral service to look like? What would you like to cremate or bury your daughter? Would you like to do an autopsy? We quickly learned that insurance doesn't cover autopsies for stillborn children, because they're not recognized as people, because they never took a breath. So in the months that followed, we grieved in silence. We did exhaustive research, which led us to the undisputable conclusion that Reese's death was, in fact, preventable. We signed check after check for hospital bills, funeral services, psychology visits. Each time I signed my name on those checks, it hurt a little bit more, knowing that the investment was for a child that we could not take home with us. Someday when I'm older and I'm getting ready to meet Reese in heaven, I hope I can look back and say that November 2nd, 2014 was the worst day of our lives. So on behalf of all families, stillbirth families throughout the state of Minnesota, Amanda and I graciously urge you to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. Any questions for the Duffys, Chris or Amanda? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And more of a comment. Just hearing your story breaks my heart. I just gave birth to my firstborn son about 2 months ago, and I can't even imagine what you went through. And I want to thank you for being here today, and I'm hoping we can get this bill passed to help more families like you. And it sounds like there's more that needs to be done. The tax credit helps, but if we can also look at ways to prevent this from happening in the future, I think that would be a good thing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for members? So Representative Lewin.
Well, thank you, and I'd just like to add to Representative Wells' comments and thank the Duffys for being here. Actually, attend church in Eden Prairie with your family, and I know our entire church has grieved with you over your tremendous loss. So thank you for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lewin. Representative Knobloch.
And you certainly have my sympathies, too. It just, I can't imagine going through something like that. I'm sure it's just very, very difficult. I guess my question is actually for Mr. Michael. Mr. Michael, I think I know the answer to this, but I assume that the there are no federal sort of tax benefits for a stillborn child. For example, I mean, the personal exemption that people get, that's not something that is applicable in the year that a stillborn child is born. Is that right?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, that's correct. The dependent exemption only applies to a live birth. So, there is no federal tax benefit that would flow through to the state.
Chairman Knobloch.
That was my question. Thank you.
Any other questions for members? If not, we will go to the next testifier. We have Dale and Carrie Fuller, and then Lindsay. We'll wrap it up here. Dale and Carrie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My wife unfortunately couldn't be here with us this morning, so I'm the sole testifier. But my name is Dale Fuller.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am here today to thank you and hopefully get your support for House File 2969. Which, as we have, as already stated, it's a $2,000 tax credit for stillbirth parents. I'm not here today as a tax professional or medical professional, but as a grieving father. Myself, as the Duffys, have been impacted by stillbirth, and we strongly believe that this bill will help hundreds of Minnesota families a year with a little bit of financial reprieve that they spend on this tragedy. I'll just briefly tell you my story, which was back in 2014. My wife and I were expecting our second child. It was a son. We had already had a two-year-old daughter. My wife was just a few days from her due date, and she went to her last doctor's appointment, like many full-term women do. That morning, I just put the car seat in the car. The baby's room was ready. Our family was eagerly waiting for our news. But my wife, unfortunately, on May 15th, tragedy struck. My wife, at her last appointment, they went in and they could not find her heartbeat, the baby's heartbeat. My wife called me at work. She was obviously upset, screaming over the phone. I couldn't even understand her. I left work. I rushed to the clinic, and I asked the doctor, how could this happen? You know, we're delivering our child in a couple days. And she just threw up her hands and said, this happens. It happens 300 to 400 times a year in the state of Minnesota to healthy babies, healthy pregnancies. So we were obviously distraught. We thought we would have our baby delivered right away that afternoon, but we were told to go home because they did not have any time for deliveries that day. But the next morning, we delivered our son, Landon, who I also have brought a picture of the Duffys. He was otherwise a healthy 8-pound baby boy. As you can see, full head of hair, fully developed. And we found out many stillbirth families do not find out the reason of what took their child, but fortunately for us, we found out there was a knot in his umbilical cord that cut off his circulation, and that does happen to 8,000 babies a year in the country, but there are 26,000 stillbirths a year in the United States. That's an alarming number. I mean, if you think about it, if next year 26,000 children died from the Zika virus, there would be a national health crisis. But for some reason, stillbirth remains in the shadows. So as the Duffys, we were left with the decision to do an autopsy. I knew my wife would not get maternity leave. I was not going to get paternity leave. We did no longer qualify for FMLA because we did not bring home a living child. We knew that we couldn't have an autopsy. Health insurance does not cover the autopsy costs for children that are born sleeping. And we didn't know what to do. Fortunately, my parents donated their cemetery lot to us, so we didn't have to pay for the lot in the cemetery, but we did have to pay out of pocket for the funeral expenses and additional medical expenses. So as you can see, there's a gray area that these children fall into. I've worked with the same company for 13 years, and I have paid for a group life insurance plan, which covers $10,000 to $20,000 for me and any of my dependents. A lot of big corporations offer that to their employees. I filed a claim, and I was denied because my son didn't take a breath. He needed to have been born and taken a breath for me to collect any life insurance benefits. So we were left with all of the costs out of pocket, like many stillborn children do. So as you can see, it's extremely difficult when to hear that as a parent and to bury a child who meant so much to you, but they're really not looked at by insurance companies or by the government. So just to conclude, the bill would mean a lot to us. We think it would be a small price to pay for the state and very symbolic. As Representative Peterson already said, you do get issued a birth certificate resulting in a stillbirth by the Minnesota Department of Health, so it's easy for a family to prove that they've had this loss, and we would greatly appreciate your support. Thank you. And I'll open up for questions.
Questions for Mr. Fuller. Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Thank you very much. Lindsay, now help me with the last name.
Wimmer.
Wimmer, okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm the Executive Director of Star Legacy Foundation. We're a national stillbirth advocacy organization based here in Eden Prairie. We started Star Legacy after my son, Garrett, was stillborn almost 11 years ago. And I'm here to tell you, too, that this pain doesn't go away. The Duffys and the Fullers have experienced their losses, but it's something that we live with for the rest of our lives. As an organization, our goals include supporting research and education that leads to the optimal support of bereaved families and the prevention of many of these stillbirths. The Duffys and the Fullers are two examples of the more than 400 families in Minnesota who experience a fetal death every year. Stillbirth has been identified or defined as the unintended death of a baby after 20 weeks gestation, but without taking that first breath. And as Mr. Fuller said, there's 26,000 babies that are stillborn in the United States every year. Research into stillbirth is extremely lacking. As many as two-thirds of these families will never know why their baby died. A child who is born alive qualifies for a tax exemption, even if the baby dies within minutes after birth. And we believe a stillborn baby should qualify for the same benefits. The parents of stillborn babies accept the burden of many financial costs. The normal preparation for the baby's arrival, crib, car seats, prenatal care, the hospital charges for the labor and delivery. But then they also have the funeral expenses, cremation or burial, autopsy fees, and has been mentioned, are not covered by health or life insurance. Many of these families need to take a leave in order to grieve, and dependent on their employer, sometimes this is a leave that is honored and sometimes not. Many families are also required to seek professional counseling in order to navigate the emotional and psychological toll that this takes on them and their family. This can add up to thousands of dollars. But this bill is about a lot more than just the dollars. It's about recognizing these babies and the families that love them. As has been mentioned, there's four states that have already passed similar legislation, and Minnesota has the opportunity to be the fifth. Minnesota is known nationally as a leader in stillbirth advocacy, and so we're very proud of the work that's been done already in the state and hope to continue that. So I just hope that we can respectfully urge you to support this bill and take advantage of this opportunity to recognize these babies and their families. I also would just like to add a side note that the Duffys, the Fullers, myself, or anyone else that today would be testifying for this would not be able to benefit from this bill. This is all moving forward. And so all of these efforts are done for the sole sake of those families who will follow us. We're trying to minimize the burden and some of the anguish for families that will follow in this journey behind us. So thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for the witness? Okay, I want to thank the Duffys, the Fullers, and Ms. Wimmer for your testimony today. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2969 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Peterson, and to your testifiers. Item next, Representative Metza. I will move House File 3852. There is an A1 amendment. Is there any? Is that an author's amendment?
Yes.
Okay. So I will move House File 3852. I will move the H3852A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Okay. Representative Metz, a two-year bill. But first of all, before we get started, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Would the department have any comments on this at this point? Not right now. Okay. Welcome, committee. Sir, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that essentially we're in the workings and under a non-disclosure agreement right now, so I can't get too much into the specifics of what the actual project would be. But I did bring Mr. Peterson from the IRRRB to present.
First of all, Metz, I would guess that your project that you can't talk to us about has something to do with siting.
It does, Mr. Chair. That we can talk about.
Okay, Metza.
So essentially, Mr. Chair and committee members, what this does is allows for a sales tax exemption if a siting facility was built not before in terms of the exemption, but after the money is spent in the form of a rebate. And the total cost on the project, as you can see in your description, is roughly $400 million that we're estimating for the construction. And it would kick off essentially as soon as this summer if everything kind of comes into line. So this would be one of a few things we're working on, Mr. Chair. I know I've got a few other bills in regard to the siting incentive that we'll kind of mull through to see what fits best for these types of manufacturers to want to locate in Minnesota to build renewable siding similar to OSB and or, you know, other companies we've had and lost up on the range, similar like Potlatch. And so this would be that type of siding, renewable, friendly for our environment, and both good jobs in the manufacturing facility and the spinoff in relation to our hardworking loggers in northeastern Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Representative Metz. So Ms. Dalton, I'm looking at the revenue estimate here. And Representative Metz had mentioned that they'd be done probably next year, but yet we have money in the tail, so this is an ongoing appropriation. Whoever fits in this category would receive the benefit. And what happens if there's more than $400 million? It just stops at $400 million. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, you are correct that if there was more than one facility that cost $400 million that produced at least 400 million board feet of siding a year, the second facility would qualify as well. The reason there's ongoing costs is that because it's a refund, not all the costs will be, not all the sales tax will be collected immediately. Some of it will go into other year.
Okay. You have a witness. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, please, sir, and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Steve Peterson, and I work for the IRRRB, the Director of Development.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. So we have been in negotiations with a large siding manufacturer for quite some time now, and they have expressed an interest in locating in northeastern Minnesota. So we are putting together a proposal to attract them to a site, and we are currently in competition with Canada and Michigan as well. So we are hoping that the committee will look favorably upon this bill for the incentive that we're asking for, so we can move forward with negotiations, bring something back to the table with this company. I'll be happy to answer any questions that members may have.
Thank you, sir. Questions for members? Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the author or Mr. Peterson. I know you can't talk in detail about the particular offer that might be available to you up there in the range, but tell me what the, if you could talk generally, what are the economic conditions that are different here in which you would need a sales tax exemption from what they are in Michigan or Canada that brings you to the table here to ask for some tax relief?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I am not sure what Canada or Michigan are doing on their negotiations. I do know that we felt that this would be an added attraction along with some of the other incentives that we're proposing to get them to locate. This is a significant facility, 400,000 square feet under roof, which would employ directly 250 folks working there. So we felt that with the current economic situation in northeastern Minnesota being what it is, we went all out for this facility and hoping that this, along with the other incentives, would be an attraction.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Sure. Thank you very much. And I support the concept of your bill, Representative Metza, because in tax committee here, I've shared many times the issues we have in Chisago County, being a border community with Wisconsin, and also being the eighth county of a seven-county metro area that shares revenue through fiscal disparities. We don't often compete very well with Wisconsin. In fact, a former EDA director has said that 17 of the 20 businesses in the Osceola, Wisconsin Industrial Park are from Minnesota. And they're in Wisconsin, Osceola, right across the border, right across the river, for a reason. So I get it. I totally understand. But wondering if there's a little more detail you could provide about the economic conditions that result in this particular benefit maybe tipping us over. Do you have anything at all that you could share with us regarding us versus Michigan versus Canada as it relates to the factors that would cause us to want to eliminate a particular tax that they would have to pay?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, the only thing I know that in Canada's instance, they did offer a significant dollar amount to this company in the past, and they have to other companies that we've dealt with, much more so than we are able to offer in Minnesota. What we've done is located a site in White Lakes, the Laskin Industrial Park, and I can share that with you. That is currently owned by Minnesota Power. And so we can, the site is very, very attractive to this company. Minnesota Power has stepped up their game as well with some incentives. And we are looking at possibly entering into a long-term lease for that site. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question directly or not, but I guess we're just trying to get all the partners together, including the state, you folks, DEED, IRRRB, Minnesota Power, to put together the best package, incentive package that we can to attract this company. I know the competition is very fierce. One of the other issues that we face with attracting a major wood user is we have an abundance of forests that are underutilized, but the competition is fierce along the east coast, along the border states there. They have a growing season much longer than ours. Trees harvest at a much much faster rate than us. So there's a lot of competition out there for industries like this, and I think Minnesota is poised right now with these incentives to bring this company forward.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you share with us the extent that the IRRRB will be providing some tax relief? What's the dollar amount of that, and how does that contribute to the overall package?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, we currently have a proposal working with the IRRRB, DEED, and the 21st Century Minerals Fund, three different tranches of money, funds that we would put forward along with funds from Minnesota Power. We could be looking at a total between all of those up to $60 million for this project. No, that depends on the size and scope of the project. We have a non-binding proposal with the company, so it'll be several different pots of money.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on that, too.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one other thing to include is actually the community of White Lakes, who will also have some skin in the game in regards to some road entrance for logging trucks. We know that in a project like this, there would be well over 100 trucks fully loaded coming in per day, and that the city would also have some skin in the game in that, potentially some wastewater and sewer upgrades in their community as well, which is another reason they're kind of coming, is because the entire, well, so far, the entire group of people active, I think, have been very genuine. I know Minnesota Power, and we've got one of their representatives here, is they're in favor of this bill. It would be a good long-term customer for them as well. And essentially, we feel that if we can kind of get the right pieces of the puzzle together, that we'd be in a very strong position to win this project over for the company we're aiming to attract, as well as put it out on the map again that Minnesota is open for natural resource harvesting in wood products, which we've actually been trying to do through both the agency and with the help of the legislature with products or projects like Sweetwater, which is going into Mountain Iron, and others. So we're really trying to put ourselves on the forward-thinking map for any wood product industry that we can attract here to the state to grow the region, not only in northeastern Minnesota, but wherever we do have good lumber to harvest, which could be north central Minnesota as well. So,
short-term, Matt, so this would be beneficial to the Mesaba East Giants?
That it would, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. How many permanent full-time jobs would be would we get if this bill were to pass, if the company would come from wherever they're at, full-time, permanent, at that site, at the siding manufacturing site?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, they're looking at 250 full-time direct, and with the indirects, at 100 and approximately 115 logging trucks per day. Minnesota uses a multiplier in the logging industry of 2.4 for that sector, and then there will be many other service folks, providers that will be involved. So there, it's a substantial amount of employment.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, just a couple of brief clarifying points here. The first of which is the IRRRB does not provide tax relief. The IRRRB is a tax collector from the iron ore mining companies, $2.60 a long ton. From that, loans, low interest loans and grants are made to cities and entrepreneurs for economic development and diversification, of which this project is really an attractive one. My second point of clarification is we are competing for this project with Canada and the state of Michigan. We are at a particularly harsh economic disadvantage by virtue of two things. One, both national forests in northeastern Minnesota, the Chippewa and the Superior, are governed and regulated by the federal government. And it has been a constant irritation to not only all of us from up north, but you as well, that the federal policies in terms of sustainable harvest has been really deplorable. And we have not been able to get that wood harvested when it's time, and it's just a shame how much of that wood is allowed to be destroyed simply because of age. The last point. The competition with the Canadians is difficult because the Crown owns the wood. And it's that, literally, that subsidy that makes the raw material available to a company to manufacture a product, that becomes very attractive to them. So that is why in this bill, and with Representative Metza's good work and Mr. Peterson's good work, we're trying to patch together enough of an incentive package to counteract that issue with the Canadians. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anstelz. Representative Hackbarth. Chairman Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Peterson, or Representative Metza. I think what you said was you're putting together a package that could amount to maybe $60 million from the IRRB. Maybe you could clarify that.
In total, yes.
Has there been any grants or loans given out at this point?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbart, no, there has not been any grants or loans. There's been no money expended on this project other than some preliminary engineering work to determine whether or not the site is suitable. But we have not given any money out, or have we offered any money to the company at this time. It's a non-binding proposal based on certain criteria.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Hackbart. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michaels. The state has a history, I believe, of offering these tax incentives to businesses, and I'm just curious as to how many approximately do we usually put into law, maybe the last 6 years or so, is my first question.
Ms. Dalton, how many?
Mr. Chair, there's normally 2 to 5 every year that we've been funding, I would say, over the last 6 years.
Representative McDonald?
When we have a tax bill.
Thank you.
Rub it in. Representative McDonald.
And then secondly, what is the cost to the sales tax exemption where there's a sales tax form they have to send in and then the state sends it back as opposed to maybe a point of purchase sales tax exemption? There must be a cost to that to the
Ms.
state.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, in some of these instances, it's actually cheaper for the state to do it as a refund than to do it as an upfront exemption because of the audit costs that would otherwise be incurred by the state if there were multiple builders and contractors and subcontractors that all needed to be audited to make sure that the exemption was used appropriately. So I think it kind of depends on each individual project.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then last question for the author, Representative Metza. Would you agree with the statement then that according to your bill or previous bills that we've heard that offer a sales tax exemption or a reduction or a elimination, that it does indeed stir economic boost to the economy?
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, yes, I actually on my first term worked for providing resort owners similar expansion on their projects, which I know is being carried by a different author this year, and I don't know if it was heard yet in committee. I think it was, and I'm seeing a head nodding yes, but yes, I do believe that things like this help not only necessarily expand a business in many of those cases for small resort owners, large resort owners, in remodeling costs or upgrading their facility, you know, potentially providing more income to be gained and taxed on the backside. And in this case, I do believe so as well, that this would be a incentive that the state would see in recouped income tax and other things, plus the added benefit of putting a lot of northeastern Minnesota people in particular to work, but also growing the local economy, the local tax base, and alleviating things like, you know, property tax rises for if a city were to bore this cost on its own. So absolutely, I wholeheartedly believe that things like this to incentivize either new business and or help current businesses in Minnesota do help if they're done properly, I think, and with the due diligence. And I know, Mr. Chair, that you have a hawk's eye when it comes to watching these kinds of incentives. So we'd, again, just appreciate the committee's support, and we're willing to work with you along the way to make the legislation better if needed.
Representative McDonald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I knew you would agree with me because you're a smart man, and it's a good bill.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question, I don't recall, but what was the original motion for this bill?
It'll be to be laid over.
Okay. So, Representative Metza, my question would be for you then. And let me just say that I fully support what you're trying to do here, and I'm glad that you're doing this, and I wish you the best of luck in trying to attract this business and other businesses as you try to address what I know is a pretty difficult time on the Iron Range. But as I read the bill, I don't see that it's that the tax relief, if this were signed into law, the tax relief would not be limited to a siding production facility constructed on the Iron Range. And maybe that's by design. I'd just like to hear your comments on that, if you would.
Representative Metza?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. We didn't want it to lock in a specific location as all that's kind of being worked out. We know that there is one site in particular that is very attractive to everyone involved, but we did not want to lock it in specifically in Representative Ansel's region. There is a lot of space as well, and we feel that you know, wherever the jobs end up going would be a good step in the right direction for Minnesota. You know, they're going to be long-term. You know, I don't think a company who is looking to invest over $400 million potentially to get this done is looking at a, you know, short-term win in Minnesota. When you're putting in that kind of money, it's different than going to, say, a TIF district in a community getting a five-year incentive. This is more poised to be a long-term investment both for the state and the employees who would end up working at the facility. So we don't see it being something short-term and do not want to send a signal that we're going to lock them into one spot. We want this company to be able to, and or any other company who would be willing to take advantage of this, to be able to do their business where they best see fit doing it. You know, transportation modes will, of course, be prudent in that. There's rail at the site in White Lakes that Mr. Peterson referenced. And so I think with all those things in play, we wanted to leave wiggle room for them to fit where they fit best.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you.
Representative Knobloch and Ansel. Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza or Peterson, I guess just kind of a technical question. So when it says, I guess the capital equipment involved in the project would not be taxable underneath our current law. So when you say building materials and supplies, what are supplies? I mean, it sounds like a good project, but I mean, are these building-related supplies, or are these some kind of other supplies that you'd otherwise pay sales tax on to get the business going? Any idea?
Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair. Essentially, this would be, from my knowledge, a very typical sales tax deduction, things like metal roofing, assuming that it was some form of metal on there, or rubber roofing, steel to build the facility for any support structure. And I don't think the equipment would be included in it. I think it would be limited to the actual building materials that we'd see many building and construction trades projects around the state, similar to probably the Viking Stadium when you think of the materials used there, glass if it's there, doors, things of that nature, paint, but not everything.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Knobloch. Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as the issue of location is concerned, economic development in northeastern Minnesota is tricky and difficult. And one of the classic mistakes that we've learned from is to not dictate to entrepreneurs where to build or where to co-locate or where to expand their businesses. But I think it's fair to assume that in order to attract support from the taconite production tax, that this or any other economic development project must be within the six-county taconite assistance area in order to take advantage of the taconite production tax money. So it'll be somewhere in the six-county region.
And that could be amended to include Fillmore County, just so the committee members. I would always work with Rufo
Bina. That's been tried.
Fillmore County had Hanna Mines back in the day, and they did quite a bit of iron mining, actually, but Rukovina would never let me in. So any other questions for members on this bill? Okay, thank you, Mr. Peterson and Representative Metza. I will renew my motion that House File 3052, as amended, be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Metza. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and we'll get information out about this as we can under the non-disclosure and keep the committee apprised to any updates.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go out of order just a little bit because I know we have a witness from a ways. I'm going to go to House File 3292 because I'm going to be taking a call in a little bit, so I probably should be here for my bill. I think that would be good. So if you could please come down. I will move House File 3292, and the motion will be to lay it over. It's a David Slocum bill, so it's half good. Slocum?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Okay, so with that, if the gentleman could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Paul Winkler from Education Minnesota, and also a Mesabi East Giant graduate.
No way.
Yes.
Really?
Class of 1990.
Wow. That's all the older you are?
Are you saying I look older, Chair David?
Oh, you're much older. No. Okay. So you're a giant. Okay, that's cool. And if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Joy Whipred, and I represent Mora, Minnesota. I'm a high school teacher in Mora and coach in Mora.
What do you teach there?
I'm a history teacher, and I also coach golf.
Wow. What kind of golf balls do you use?
Right now, we ordered some Nikes. So the Titleist Pro V ones are just too expensive.
Yeah. Tax credit for Pro V ones, I think. Or Pro V one X's. Okay, who would like to start on 3292?
I think I'd like to start, Chair David's.
Now that's one with the Mustangs, right?
It is.
The mighty Mustangs.
Absolutely. Okay.
Mr. Winkler.
Chair Davids, members of the committee, thank you for considering this bill. As you all know, Minnesota is facing a severe teacher shortage across the state of Minnesota, and we have this shortage for a number of reasons. Education Minnesota has done extensive research paper on this topic, and we have found that, among other things, teachers are feeling like they have lost a lot of voice in their classroom and autonomy. There's too much stress put on testing, and our special education teachers are also buried in paperwork. But one of the other things we found out is that our teachers are simply having a hard time making ends meet as they go through this with high student loan debt, increased costs for health insurance, and basically a low starting salary. Education Minnesota and legislators across the political spectrum are putting a lot of ideas forth on this topic. Because of this crisis, Representative Erickson has put together a teacher shortage bill, Representative Fenton, Representative Paul Anderson, and many other legislators, both Republican and Democrat, are working on this. Some legislators are giving more voice to teachers. Some are putting more efforts into special ed caseloads. Representative Loon is putting together a bill that would give more staff development to some teachers. These are all really important discussions on recruiting and retaining teachers, as a very complicated topic of why people are leaving this profession and coming into this profession. I'd really like to thank Representative Davids and Dabney for looking at this problem through the tax code. This bill would do four things, essentially. It would give a tax credit to teachers or for our paraprofessionals, or school employees who would like to get their initial license. These are often people of color who want to become teachers. They often know what it's like to be a teacher, so when they go through the program of becoming a teacher, they stay in teaching. This bill would also help our teachers want to expand their license. So, for instance, I am a civics teacher. If I would like to expand my teaching license to a special ed area, this would also help me with the tuition I pay on the tax credit. We also have a very serious problem, which Joy will talk about in a minute, about our concurrent enrollment teachers. Essentially, in my conversations with teachers across the state that have not met the Higher Learning Commission's requirements, they fear that there is not much incentive for them to get their master's in their core content area because they often have to do a lot of work and it costs a lot of money. Lastly, if you know nationally board certified teachers, these are some of the best teachers in the state, and this bill would also help them give a tax credit for their tuition that they pay for. So this is a complicated issue, and I appreciate that we can have a discussion about tax policy. This is not a place that I'm an expert, but I think Joy will tell you a story on why it's important. Thank you.
Okay. Before we go on, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Is there anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on the Slocum bill? Does the department wish to weigh in?
Not at this time.
Not this time. Not even as a resource?
Not at this time.
With that being said, the Slocum-Davids bill, let's go on with the witness. If you would please introduce yourself and provide your testimony, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joy Whitbread, and like I said, I've been a teacher in Mora High School for the past 11 years. For the past 6 years, I have had the opportunity to teach a concurrent enrollment class through St. Cloud State University. This class has been a huge opportunity for many of the students in my district, as we come from a very rural district, and the opportunity for these students to gain 3 college credits at no cost to them has been a huge blessing. And not to mention myself, I have gained a great deal of knowledge from teaching this course. With this class, the students have been able to transition to a college setting much easier than if they just took that leap immediately after graduation. The problem being is that this coming year I will not be able to teach this class. As I said, through St. Cloud State, I will not be allowed to teach it because my master's is in education through St. Mary's University. It is not in my content area, which would need to be history. This is problematic because I already have a master's degree that cost approximately $12,000. If I started a second master's program, just so that I'd be able to teach this course, it would cost closer to $12,000. And this is not something that my family can take on as a financial burden, not to mention the time that it would take to complete the second master's program. In my heart, as a teacher, I would love to give this opportunity and to continue teaching this course for the betterment of my students. However, the strain on my family and the financial strain cannot happen. So many of you will ask, what are other options that I have? There really are none at this time. We have had to drop this class from registration for next year's students and for any juniors and seniors that have the opportunity to take this class. Currently, I have 46 students who benefit from my class, not to mention the other concurrent enrollment classes that we offer. But for this to continue and for this program to continue, this legislation would be extremely important and would incentivize many teachers as myself to want to go and get these continuing ed credits so that we can offer this opportunity for our students.
Thank you. St. Mary's Cardinals?
Yes.
Okay. With that, how big is Mora?
Mora, we have 3,600 is our population. Our student population is around 900.
Okay. Do you have a Dairy Queen?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Questions for members? Representative Erickson. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to call you Joy, but I know I shouldn't say that. is it St. Cloud State who has said that you cannot teach, or is it the Higher Learning Commission? Because my understanding is that we're in a transition time. So has St. Cloud State issued this
yes.
edict?
Sorry.
Ms. Whitbread.
Sorry. Yes, St. Cloud State has... every university is different. They can make their own guidelines, and St. Cloud State has said that they would like to start this transition process next fall. With the Higher Learning Commission, I would have until 2022. Mm-hmm. However, that is not what St. Cloud State would like.
Chair Erickson.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, that's very disappointing because I think the other colleges and universities are following the Higher Learning Commission's recommendation or holding pattern. So that's very disappointing. Perhaps Representative Loon wants to weigh in as well.
Representative Loon and then Barrett. Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson, for raising that. Yes, that is concerning, and there has been a group of legislators concerned about the Higher Learning Commission's actions that have been meeting, and it's included representatives from MNSCU, from the University of Minnesota, and others working on trying to find some solutions. Obviously, there's hope and desire that the HLC will change its mind, but in lieu of that, if they don't, to try to offer online courses from, you know, our state's university and MNSCU system institutions that could help with some of these requirements. We've talked also about some incentives, such as the bill before us today. But it is really disappointing to hear that, because when the chancellor of MNSCU and a representative from the U in these meetings have indicated that they understand the problem this poses and that we want students to have the opportunity to take college courses through concurrent enrollment, that really seems to run counter to the efforts that are being done to help work through this this issue to the benefit of our students. So I will take that back to the next meeting on that Higher Learning Commission. Thank you for letting us know.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. You okay?
Yes, thank you.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, a quick question on line 1.23 regarding the teacher preparation program. You might have answered this question already, and I apologize if you have. I'm wondering what the cost generally is for the teacher preparation program, so that you'd get up to a $3,000 credit for that program. Specifically, just to get to my next point of the costs involved in getting a teaching certificate through master's degree and so forth versus the cost of maybe a paraprofessional or other teacher getting certified through another means. But anyway, if you could answer that question, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Winkler.
Chair Davids, Representative Barrett. I looked at some research last night about the University of Minnesota costs, and it looks like it's about $1,300 for a master's credit. I know there's a Grow Your Own program through through Minneapolis Public Schools, and I believe that there's been a deal made between the university and the Minneapolis Public School Grow Your Own program, and I believe that cost is $15,000 for their
tuition.
So that's on a discounted level. So you can see that that would be, if you don't have that agreement, it would be much more than that. And I think it depends on where you are in your program of getting your license. If you have a bachelor's degree, for instance, when I went back to school to become a teacher, I need to fill six other classes at a bachelor's degree and then get my teaching license credits as well. So it's going to vary, I think.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a great bill. It's authored by Chair Davids and Representative Slocum. So it's a great bill. But I was just wondering about the difference in cost between someone trying to get their special ed license. Well, like my wife, she went back to college, got a bunch of master's classes, finished 2 or 3 years, 4.0 GPA, by the way, through all of that. But that would be different than the cost of attaining a teacher preparation program, and the credit's the same. So I thought that was, interesting that the credit would be the same regardless of the cost that you incur. Where, in my mind, because I'm aware of all the costs involved in getting in the master's level classes, that's huge, and we're still paying off loans. So the credit, could be higher or different depending on which area you go through, would be seem to be logical in my mind. But anyway, it's a great bill, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Vice Chair Barrett. Representative Kosnick, then I think we'll move on to the next bill unless there's other questions. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think at the nice bill as well, and I was just kind of like curious about it says line 1.18 employed by a Minnesota public school. Am I right that a private school teacher or educator would not qualify for this credit, and perhaps that's something we should consider?
Ms. Manzi. To the Kosnick comment. Is this just public school teachers, or would it include private? Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, I believe Representative Kosnick is correct. The qualified educational professional definition is an individual employed by a public school on lines 1.18 to 1.20. And then if you look at line 2.8 on the back page, you have to be a qualified educational professional to claim the credit. The only thing I would add is that I think this is written to include employees of charter schools. So it would not include the non-public schools, but I believe it would include charter school employees.
President Kosnick.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like your bill and let you do with what you'd like with it, but something that maybe we could consider.
It's a work in progress.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. With that, Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can someone, either Representative Loon or Representative Erickson, explain what the conflict is that you're talking about?
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Earhart. Well, briefly, it's the higher institutions of higher learning in the state of Minnesota are all part of what's called the higher learning mission, and it's an accreditation organization that they voluntarily belong to, and it's, I don't know, we're part of, it's maybe like 20 states or more than that that are part of that commission, and they issued basically a directive that in order to be qualified to teach college credits at any institution of higher learning that's accredited through them, you must have a master's degree in your content area. And this conflicts with a program we have in our public schools, K-12, where we allow high school students to take college credit in their high schools and taught by high school teachers. They are under the mentorship arrangement with an institution of higher learning, but many of them do not have a specific master's degree in their content area, such as history in the example of Ms. Whitbread. So they have... Basically, we have appealed to them on this edict. They are very firm and resolute in this directive. So now we're trying to figure out how we can keep concurrent enrollment is a very popular option for our students to gain college credit while they're in high school, how we can continue to offer that and also meet the directives of the accreditation organization that our higher learning institutions belong to.
Thank you. That leads to a question. There are other professions besides teachers that need boosts in credits and so forth for them to acquire a master's or further their college education. And I know we need teachers, but there are other professions. And I will give you an example of that. I brought a bill last year for we do not have enough airline pilots coming up, and we're going to have run into a shortage very soon because the military is not kicking out pilots anymore, and they need some tuition relief for that skill. And and I'm sure there are others, but why are we just talking about this particular area?
Well, I guess that probably goes to the author. Now, and afterwards, I really don't want to get an education policy. I really don't want to go there. We've got qualified folks, Dabney and Erickson and Loon and others and Carlson that can do that. I want to talk about the tax credits for this bill. Why not for other areas? Bring the bills. We'll hear them. I like tax credits for education. If you're in the corporate world, a lot of corporations have programs where they will pay, and, of course, they get to deduct the cost, will pay for people to further go get their master's, whatever. So this is one area that I've picked out to try and help out, but we're certainly, I've never met a tax credit bill I haven't liked that I can think of.
Well, Mr. Chairman, did this go to higher education? Because that's where my bill went. It never got out of there.
I wrote it a little differently.
Okay, that's enough.
Thank you, Chair. Any other questions? Okay, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm curious how they define, maybe this is a question for Representative Loon, it sounded like you serve on that commission. How do they define content area? And I'll tell you why I asked the question. My field was the social sciences, and most of you know I'm a retired teacher. But take the field of economics. Sometimes that's considered a business subject. Sometimes it's considered a social studies subject. That's why I asked the question, how do they define, and you're a history teacher, if I recall, our witness. do they have kind of a broad definition, or is it a narrow one? And various colleges and universities. Now, the college I attended, economics was considered a social studies field or course. Other colleges, it's considered a business course.
Let's chair load, and then we'll probably move on after that because we're getting in the education field, which I really don't care to do. Chair Loon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson.
Nothing wrong with education. I think everybody should have one.
You know, I think that's a good question. It's, and again, I'd have to go back and look at some of the specifics, but it's 18, I believe it's 18 credit hours that you must have in master's credits in your core content area and pertinent to the concurrent enrollment course that you're proposing to teach. So maybe you're a social studies teacher, but if you're going to teach a specific history course, you have to have a master's that covers that specific history course that you're teaching, and however that's defined. And it could be a little different from which higher learning institution you're going to.
Chair Carlson?
Yeah, I think I'll just stop there because you want to move on, but I think it does raise the question of the vagueness of the area, because sometimes courses in my example are considered business, sometimes it's considered in the social sciences. If you have a broad field of maybe a major or a master's in social studies, at least with K-12 licensure, I was able to teach all social studies courses. I had a broad major with a political science core, but that was undergraduate. And I know we're talking here about masters, but at any rate, I'll just stop there, Mr. Chairman. It's something that I think needs to be resolved as well.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Chair Erickson, very briefly.
Yes, very briefly. Ms. Withbread, can Mora have an agreement with some other MNSCU organization than St. Cloud State University? I'm thinking of a college or university that may not have this strident policy that St. Cloud State has adopted.
Whitford?
Yes, absolutely. We've looked into working with the University of Minnesota. However, that stipulation of continuing credits needs to be met eventually. So we would be buying ourselves some time.
How about UW-Superior?
Ooh, I went there for a year. That might be an option.
Okay. With that, thank you very much, members. Thank you, Mr. Winkler. Thank you, Ms. Whitbread. And what I say is go Mustangs. I'll move the House File 3292. Be later for possible inclusion omnibus tax bill. Thank you for the good questions, members, and for the witnesses. Item next, speaking of education, I will move House File 2573. Chairman Nornes, we're very fortunate to have with us here today. And so I will move House File 2573, and this again will be for later for possible inclusion in the tax bill. With that being said, is there anyone in the audience wish to testify in support of this bill, House File 2573? Anyone in the audience with concerns? Does the Department of Revenue wish to weigh in? Not this time. Okay, so I'll move House File 2573. Welcome, Chair Nornes, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's always a pleasure to be in front of the Tax Committee. Don't get this opportunity very often. Today, we're talking about small business and how we can help small businesses in our state through the tax policy. Specifically, the bill is dealing with the tax on game release fees. Our witness today has a game farm, and there are many others in the state of Minnesota like him. He's speaking on their behalf today. So we're looking for a tax exemption on this particular item. It goes back to the early 2000s when there was an interpretation made that has resulted in this tax being imposed. I'd like to turn it over to Les Bench now, and he will explain the rest of the details.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Les Bench. We own a business in western Minnesota between Alexandria and Fergus Falls. It's a hunting preserve, and also the new location of the University of Minnesota Eco Center, which is just being developed. In 2002, we had a tax ruling with the Department of Revenue that basically stated that pheasants was a taxable item. We did the research. You do have a handout, which we explained some of the past history on this ruling. And we disagreed with the ruling at the time. We had concurrence in the House and the Senate, but in the conference committee, I didn't show up. I didn't know of the date, and the deputy commissioner at the time got the definition included as far as taxable items as food product, pheasants. Pheasants, according to the Department of Agriculture, the state of Minnesota, and the Department of Natural Resources, is a food product. We sell that product to the customer. The release charges, in our estimation, do not exist. We have membership fees that are fully taxable. The targets associated with our business are fully taxable. But the pheasants we consider an agricultural product that should be exempt under 297A61 as a taxable item. That is the basic disagreement that we have and the solution that we would like to have recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Bench. Questions for members? Okay, thank you very much. You want to wrap it up, Representative Nornes?
I was just going to ask the witness the number of similar organizations or clubs of this type around the state. So we're not talking about just one.
Mr. Bench?
I'm the permanent vice president of the Minnesota Game Breeder Shooting Preserve Association. We sell a lot of product to North Dakota and South Dakota. We have probably about 50 clubs in the state of Minnesota. Probably the top 10 are the most significant, which we are one of those. We sell to the public 241,000 birds each year. This was the 2015 sales, which amounts to about $83,000 in sales tax revenue. This tax revenue, small item, but it goes right back into our businesses as far as capital investment and labor. So we're a significant portion of the entertainment industry within the state of Minnesota. We can't pick up and leave, nor do we want to. We enjoy the resources of the state, and we come to this committee to just have a better definition and a clarification of 297A61.
Chairman Knobloch?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Norris for the witness. I guess I've never hunted on a game preserve like this, but if I go to your preserve and I'm hunting pheasants and there's a bunch of pheasants that have been released, and then a non-released wild pheasant shows up and I shoot it, do I have to pay tax, or do you have to pay tax on that wild pheasant, or do you know if it was one of your pheasants?
Mr. Bench?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, we know if it's our pheasant or not. We can see by the nose on the pheasant if the blinder has been on it. But no, that is not a taxable item either, and we wouldn't consider it a taxable item.
We could do that though. No, oh no.
Okay. All right. Just curious.
Okay. Just one other thing: the natural pheasant hunting in the Minnesota produced about 175,000 birds. We produced 241,000. We worked very closely with the natural production.
Chairman Knobloch?
No further questions.
Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Chair Knobloch, if you want to have McDonald Farm, where my father was born, called Wings of Watertown. Now it's a preserve and a wild game preserve and great pheasant hunting there, so I'd welcome you, or anyone, anytime, but I do have a question, but I'll defer to you, Representative Knobloch.
Well, I'm not going to choose between these two fine establishments that are before us.
So Old McDonald had a farm.
Old McDonald had a farm,
yes,
Mr. Chair.
To your question.
The question, I didn't hear if you stated it, but is there, does the game firms have to charge sales tax on their birds?
That is
Mr.
the problem. We negotiated in 2002 that 25% of the bird is taxable. I'm not sure what part of the bird that is.
Just time out here. What did you just say?
25% of that bird is taxable.
Who came up with that?
That's the meat part.
Right.
Flesh part is not taxable.
Mr. Cummings, why did you do that? Mr. Cummings is a resource today. please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. And Representative McDonald has the floor, but we'll...
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to committee, sir.
I'm happy to be here today.
Sounds like it.
Mr. Chair, this issue was brought to the department's attention over a decade ago. And at the time, one of the things that we talked about is we pointed to 297A.61, subdivision 7, Mr. Chair, that talks about the sales price. So the sales price means that the measure subject to sales tax and the N means the total amount of consideration. And it further talks about that this includes charges by the seller for any services necessary to complete the sale. So, Mr. Chair, we find that at the time we were trying to think about was this a part of the complete sale, whether that was membership or admission. That was something that that we still think that there's a connection between that sale, Mr. Chair, and what is and that product taken out. When this happened, I know that there was also a push to have maybe another solution within the legislature, and that did not pass, Mr. Chair. So
there wasn't a tax bill?
Mr. Chair, I do not want to comment on that, Mr. Chair. but Mr. Chair, you know, we're what we tried to do is we tried to sit down, talk to advocates of a different reading of the 297A. We think that there's a link between this, you know, a membership and the sale of this item. If there is another type of clarity here, Mr. Chair, we'd be more than willing to work with you or others to seek that clarity.
And thank you very much. Thank you so much for that. Mr. Representative McDonald, you have the floor.
Well, just lastly, this, when a bird gets away, we usually say that's the one that got away. I'd say in this particular explanation, that's the one that got away. So due to time, I'm done with my questions.
So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2573 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Chair Nornes and Mr. Bench and Mr. Cummings. Okay, item last, I will move, Representative Ansells will move House File 3847. I don't see any amendments. And we have several witnesses. And members, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Barrett at this point. Representative Ansel moves House File 3847.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this is a bill about Social Security, and it's a bill that. The goal is to exempt more Social Security benefits from state income taxes. And the goal is also to exempt more Social Security benefits in a way that is sustainable in the long term fiscally. And additionally, the goal is to develop in law a mechanism to account for inflationary issues going back 30 years or more. This bill is supported by an organization that you're all familiar with, the American Association of Retired Persons. Transparency being my other goal here, I want you to know that I'm a member of that organization. And more important than that, Mr. Chair, this is about Social Security, and I am a recipient of Social Security benefits. And as near as I can tell, looking at the fiscal note, I will not benefit from this legislation if this legislation were to pass. So With that, I'd like to ask people from the AARP to help me a little bit in explaining the mechanism by which more tax is exempted and how this is done in a fiscally sustainable way. And we will stand for questions.
Sounds good, Representative Anzels. Welcome to the chair. And if you could state your name for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, and good morning. And thank you for your membership, Representative Anzel. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 3847. My name is Mary Jo George, and I am the State Director of Advocacy at AARP Minnesota. AARP is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization with nearly 660,000 members across Minnesota. We'd like to thank Representative Anzel for bringing this bill forward, and we stand in strong support of House File 3847. This bill would lower the tax burden for many older Minnesotans by adjusting for inflation the current Social Security tax exemption threshold that we have in law today. As you heard from Representative Anzel, Social Security exemption levels have not been adjusted for over 30 years. This means that each year, more and more lower and middle income Minnesotans are paying taxes on their benefits. In fact, the number of Minnesotans who are paying taxes on their Social Security benefits has more than doubled over the years, from about 160,000 in 1998 to more than 354,000 in 2013. As a result, the amount of Social Security benefits included in taxable income has quadrupled. Under Representative Anzel's bill, the new exemption level would be adjusted to reflect today's dollars, raising it from $25,000 to $54,000 for single filers and $70,000 for couples. It's important to note that when Social Security benefits became taxable in 1984, the median income in Minnesota was $24,436. This is a figure that's less than the exemption threshold today of $25,000. Yet today's median income for Minnesota taxpayers is over $67,000, more than 2.5 times the current exemption threshold. Thus, we believe raising this threshold, as is done in this bill, would go a long way in providing some retirement security to many middle-income taxpayers. Excuse me for tripping up on my tongue. When you are retired, it is tough to increase your income, and cost of living adjustments, when they happen at all, are small and don't often keep up with the increases in other consumer and medical goods and services like utilities and prescription drugs coverage. Thus, AARP does support this equitable progressive taxation and believes this approach does strike a balance and is an appropriate balance to meet the needs of Minnesotans. As our state ages, we do believe it's in our best interest to help our citizens remain financially independent and to help them age in their homes so they can continue to make a difference. And we believe that this bill is what one step in helping to give folks a raise by lowering their taxes a little bit. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. George. Representative Anzels, do you have quite a few people to testify in favor of your bill?
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. George is more than adequate.
Sounds good. Anyone else, show of hands, anyone else who would like to come up and testify in favor of the bill? Anyone who would like to come down with concerns? All right. Well, thank you. We'll open up to member questions, but I do have a question probably for Mr. Michael. Mr. Michael, what is the current level for the exemption threshold in current law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under current law, Minnesota follows the federal tax treatment of Social Security benefits, and there are two thresholds. The first threshold is $25,000 for single filers and $32,000 for married joint filers. And that threshold is of a measure of income called provisional income, which generally consists of federal adjusted gross income, but with only one half of Social Security benefits included in it. If your provisional income is below that first threshold, then none of your Social Security benefits are subject to tax at either the federal or state level. Now, if your provisional income is over that first threshold, then your Social Security benefits begin to be included in taxable income, and as your income goes up above that, up to 50% of your benefits are included in income until your provisional income reaches the second threshold. And the second threshold is $44,000 for married joint filers and $34,000 for single filers. Once your provisional income exceeds that second threshold, then more of your benefits are included in taxable income until at most 85% of your Social Security benefits are subject to tax at both the federal and the state level.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Questions from members? Representative Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. George, a question of AARP. I understand what you're attempting to do here with Social Security, but my question is, and probably every member of the committee, every once in a while we hear from people, for example, that are under a federal pension plan. It's not Social Security. And we do have some state employees that if they were working prior to 1979 are under what you call a basic non-Social Security but an approved plan. So I'm talking about probably literally thousands of Minnesotans that would have many of the same issues that we're talking about with Social Security. And my question of AARP then, have you been looking at that issue as well? I know this bill doesn't touch on that, mm-hmm. but is that
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you know, we haven't actually delved into that, but I do think, let me start by saying that we know that about 93% of people over 65 are receiving Social Security. So we are concerned with the 7%, as you say, that are not now under Social Security. What I'm not clear about, and I think one of the things that we've been trying to address with the Social Security is the fact that the threshold levels haven't kept up with inflation. But I think so. I think it is important to look at the folks that are receiving these other federal pensions. If in fact those pensions have not had inflationary protections, I think it would be a very reasonable thing to look at including them. But I guess we haven't done that. But I'd be willing to go back and kind of look at that. But I know, I think one of the things we've thought all along is with Social Security, we see most federal taxes typically are adjusted for inflation, whereas this one hasn't been, so we've been just trying to address that. But I think it's a fair question, and I'd be willing to go back and look into that.
Yeah.
Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, 7% sounds like a relatively small number, but when you look at all retirees, mm-hmm. I mentioned the federal, but there would be significant numbers of retired public employees, state and local, whether they were under TRA or one of the cities of the first class historically, mm-hmm. or PERA, yeah. You know, all those public plans, if they worked prior to 1979, which is when we changed it to a blend of Social Security and, let's say, TRA. And by the way of disclaimer, I wouldn't qualify either if you included them, even though I do receive a pension of having being a retired teacher, but other incomes enter in, and like the author of the bill, I will put the disclaimer out there. I wouldn't benefit from that one or what I'm talking about now, but there would be people that are locked in at relatively low pensions, if you will, because of when they worked, that could conceivably benefit, and perhaps AARP should take a look at that issue as well. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Any other member questions? Representative Anzell.
Mr. Chair, along the lines of Representative Carlson's excellent questions, I've been told that if this bill were to make it through the process and become law, approximately 260,000 Minnesotans receiving Social Security currently would receive a tax reduction of around $600 to $620. Not insignificant. And yet, in my view, responsible and sustainable.
Thank you very much, Representative Anzels. I forgot to ask if the department would like to come up and testify as a resource. No? All right. Any other member questions? With that, Representative Anzels, thank you very much. Representative Anzels renews his motion that House File 3847 be moved for possible inclusion in a future tax bill. Any other items?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. If not, we are adjourned.